So at the same time, it said, you could hit Nama Aparaj, chant, just keep chanting to overcome it. So it almost seems, in one sense,
This Darsha may be recorded or monitored for quality assurance. Yes.
So if I can't get beyond Nama Aparaj, then it's just like, better I don't chant. Because I'm just...
Okay, Mahatma, the great soul, has asked a Grihita, what would it be? Dwavingshati question, catch 22. That it says in the Jiva Dharma, Dharma of the Jiva, the Jiva Dharma, that Namaparad is worse than sin. And yet the only way to overcome Namaparad is by Harinam. And so if I can't stop committing sins, it's better not to chant.
Can't stop.
Offenses, if I can't avoid Namaparad. Talmudic type question.
I do Namaparad. I chant for a while to balance it out.
First of all, Namaparad is, in one sense, qualitatively different from sinful activities. So first, let's look at that comparison, because that, I think, has the key to the issue. I think if we really understand the distinction between pop, such as, well, root beer, it's your basic pop. I mean, sinful activity, papa, if we really look at the distinction between pop and Namaparad, name offenses, that distinction is the answer, that there's something, or there's often something involuntary about sinful activity. Arjuna says this in the Bhagavad Gita, where he's asked Krishna, Atakena Prayuktoyam, so by what is a person impelled? Atakena Prayuktoyam Papam Charati Purusha, the person commits sin. Anichana Pi Varshna, even not desiring it, O Krishna. Baladi Maniyojita, as if forced by some other power. So even Arjuna says that, Anichana Pi, even not desiring it. Yet, Namaparad, name offenses, are, I think there's something more discretionary about them. In other words, you're not forced to be a jerk. Someone just is. And so, if you consider what the offenses are, the first offense is to blaspheme the devotees. Yeah, I mean, if someone's like a serial blasphemer, I don't know, maybe they have an anger management problem or something, but, you know, there are all these 12-step programs. What are the 10 offenses? What are the 12 steps? So if someone blasphemes the devotees or dapples in polytheism, or disobeys the order of the guru. I think the nature of name offenses is that they're more voluntary, and sins sometimes are involuntary. In any case, we know that if someone consciously commits a sin, like, I don't really have to do this, but I think I will anyway, because it looks like it'll feel good. Even though you may make this distinction from Jiva Dharma between name offenses and sin, but there's a conjunction. Was it the seventh offense? Or was it the ninth offense? Namno Balat? It's either seven, eight, or nine.
Seven.
Or five, or four. Yeah, it's the offense that Namno Balat, Jasi Papa Bhuti, one who commits sin in the strength of chanting. Namno Balat, the strength of the name. Namno Balat, Jasi, one has a sinful mentality. Sort of calculating, like, I can get away with this. There, you know, once you chant the holy name, there is a perfect crime. Now you can turn that top light on there, right here. Thank you. We have valet light switching. The shop is going. That's why I had a Hindu. You know what that is, right? The shop is going. It is Saturday. So, there's a conjunction of sin and offense. Because you have, so, to say that offense against the name is worse than sin, but then there's a particular activity which is both sin and name offense. It's both, it's two in one. And so therefore, if you consider there's a special category where you intentionally commit a sin, and that is also a nama parag, then the clear inference would be that other sins are not voluntary. Because it's the voluntary sin, it's a sin that I could avoid, but I just, oh, what the heck. If that sin, which is actually also an offense against the name, which means that the other sins, which are less than name offenses, the other sins must be involuntary. So it's the first distinction we have to make. Then we say sin, we're talking about involuntary sins. And then, in terms of the offenses, the extent to which one chooses to offend the holy name. If you think about even our own behavior, let's say we just sort of chronically bully someone else, or we're just unkind to them. It's not exactly the same as, let's say, being addicted to some form of behavior. I mean, I suppose there's something like an addiction to being obnoxious. I guess some people have that, but in general, I think that the offenses are more something that you choose to do, as opposed to a sin which you're sort of forced to do, according to the Gita. So in that sense, that would be the distinction. Something you choose to do as opposed to something you're just sort of, it's beyond your control.
One of the points they make is that you commit some sin, not that you commit the seventh offense, you just commit a sin and then you chant the holy name and you become free from the reaction. Or you commit non-offerage.
Well, the extent of, if you're chanting and you're intentionally offending Krishna, clearly you are at cross purposes with yourself. And you got to figure out what you're about. You can't just, isn't it? I mean, because, again, if an offense is something intentional, then you're chanting Krishna's name, but you're intentionally offending it. So what are you doing?
Well, also,
I mean, I don't think it's not that we're addicted to offenses necessarily.
Chanting for something material is considered non-offerage.
It is. Maintaining material attachments. Well, someone could say I'm not really attached, I just want it. But
Some people say, I drink beer, but I don't drink enough to get intoxicated, so I'm not breaking the principles.
That's clever, I never thought of it. Hey, is there a time for something on our
side? So how you want to extend it.
Well, that's just, I mean, if someone's not intoxicated, first of all, it certainly indicates a highly cultured person. Beer drinkers are known to be kind of like la creme de la creme. But going back to a point of
chanting for something material.
Well, I have seen people addicted to offenses. I have seen cases in my life where someone offended devotees and really became addicted to offending devotees. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen that. They can't stop. So, from Krishna's point of view, let's say someone has, for example, a smoking addiction. They smoke, like, dried bananas or something. Or let's say cigarettes. Let's say someone's addicted. Like, I've seen that, you know. There's some people who chant Hare Krishna and all that, but they're addicted to cigarettes. Or else just to be fashionable, they put dozens of little cigarette butts in an ashtray and put it out on their patio just to be fashionable. But anyway, so, I mean, from Krishna's point of view, if someone is addicted to cigarettes, you could be addicted to something like that, but you're not intentionally harming anyone or against anyone. Make sure there's no light on in the kitchen. You could be... there's something about offending other people, offending Krishna, being malicious, being nasty, being envious, which is somehow more serious than just having some weakness. One is aggressive and malicious, the other is just a personal weakness. And I think myself, it would be easier for me to, I wouldn't say hang out with, but just, I think I would be more charitably disposed toward a person who wasn't envious, was a good, you know, nice person, but just had some personal weakness, rather than a person who was just malicious and envious. Isn't it? It's just, you know, just brush your teeth where you come over. Yourself in. Chew about 108 breath mints. So I think it's just common sense. Being sort of a non-offensive, nice person, but having some weakness is not as bad as just being malicious and envious. As far as the person who can't stop offending the holy name, it's... See, there's two possibilities. If someone is, let's say, envious and offending the name, one possibility is the person's completely nonchalant about it. Like, so what? You know, I don't care about offending the holy name. That person's obviously a real loser. But now, someone who, let's say, is just envious or recognize they have a problem, like I have a crooked, twisted streak in me or something, and so therefore I can't stop sometimes criticizing other people. So when you realize that you have a personal problem and you acknowledge that certain behavior is a problem, and then that gives you the leverage to cry out the holy name, like, I don't want to offend the devotees, I don't want to whatever. And that crying out is not offensive. In other words, if you are offending the holy name and you always offend the holy name, it means there's no recognition whatsoever on your part that you have a problem, which means you're a total loser. Because even a person who, is, let's say, offends the name but realizes I'm offensive and is unhappy about it, at least in their perhaps somewhat rare lucid moments, they would still cry out Krishna's name and say, please free me from that. And that chanting would not be offensive. And that is the non-offensive chanting that would gradually get them over their name offenses. Gotcha. Yes.
Going back to the person who's desirous of material, they need to go chanting and just like
they want gifts, like,
you know,
gift certificates from Walmart.
Money, you know, Hare Krishna, more money, Hare Krishna, the wife, Hare Krishna, husband. You know, it's like they can't get that out of their, you know, it's like the pure bhakti thing is kind of put on hold. And there's this,
but are there devotees that really just totally put it on hold and like never cry out the holy name, never? In other words, again, it seems like if there's no dimension of self-understanding, like, okay, I'm addicted to all these things and sometimes I ask Krishna for it. I realize, however, that I should just trust Krishna. And so, therefore, I sometimes chant asking Krishna to help me past these problems. So again, if someone never chants like that and always chants, you know, thinking of material things, then it just seems like they don't really have any clue to what spiritual life is. Because in Mishra Bhakti, we're mixed. Sure, I mean, we have our, sometimes we kind of get affected by the dark side of the force. But then at other times, we have some self-awareness, and it's in those moments of self-awareness that we cry out for help. So, next.
Surrender.
Surrender. Really? Mr. Ender, who was knighted and is now called Sir Ender.
We talked about this before. I want to at some point develop a course on helping devotees get in touch with their mission, their dharma. And so it seems one of the obstacles is the traditional old school surrender. like surrendering to your dharma is a cop out.
Oh no, I talked about that a lot.
Yeah,
that's just a misunderstanding of our philosophy.
So, etymologically, Kripadyante, what a paricaja, is that?
Yeah. Prapadyante, yeah, it's just a complete misunderstanding of our philosophy. The word prapadyante, prapad, pad means a... Well, pad means to go, as in pada, the going instrument. Pada, you know, your foot that goes. And so pra means for. So prapad literally just means to approach. To prapad, to Krishna, really just means to approach Krishna. And the problem is that people don't understand what surrender means. A lot of the, sort of like the first generation of devotees, most of them had this dramatic experience of giving up everything and moving into the Hare Krishna temple and putting your life in the hands of a somewhat emotionally unstable temple commander or temple president, you know, and so that kind of became engraved on the collective ISKCON psyche as the paradigmatic act of surrender. You know, you recklessly give up everything and report to the nearest ISKCON barrack or something. But actually, that's not what surrender means. Surrender means you just trust Krishna. You just put yourself in Krishna's hands, trusting that Krishna is not a religious fanatic and that Krishna will actually come up with a practical program for you. It's like you go to a gym and you surrender to a personal trainer. A qualified personal trainer is going to evaluate your strengths and weaknesses and give you a workout that's perfect for you. So Krishna is the supreme personality of personal trainer. And if you put yourself in Krishna's hands, he'll give you the perfect program. So surrender, all that's required to surrender is not that you be prepared to give up everything and move into an ashram somewhere. That may be nice for a young person, but what's required is that you trust Krishna, that he actually knows what he's doing. And he'll come up with the right program for you.
Okay. So, sometimes we have to consider, ourselves in particular situations, what is considered surrender. So, accept what's favorable to reject what's unfavorable.
Krishna tells you to consider yourself.
So, I think the problem within an institution is there's a lot of guilt around, I should do this, or other people make me believe that this is what I should do, and if I don't do it, therefore I'm not doing what's favorable, I'm not accepting favorable.
Well, first of all, there's an illusory, philosophically spurious, I think it used to be the UF football coach, Steve Spurious. Anyway, there's this false idea that to be surrendered means to denature yourself, like you should be stripped of any individual nature and just become a neutral serving instrument. And that's not at all what Krishna teaches in the Gita. Krishna teaches over and over and over again that your duty comes from your nature. It's not that you have to reinvent your nature to fit, quote-unquote, the needful, the International Society for the Needful. And so the idea that you should ignore your nature and just do the needful is diametrically opposed to the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says again and again...
We have that statement from Prabhupada, do the needful, so...
Yeah, but that has to be taken within the context of the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada's purpose in coming to this world was not to refute the Bhagavad Gita, it was to explain it. And therefore, Prabhupada's statement has to be understood within the context of the Gita and not as a refutation of the Gita. And so, first of all, there's so much needful to go around that, for example, there are many, many things that desperately need to be done that are within my nature. Whether it's writing books or lecturing, whatever. And so therefore, I don't have to go outside my nature. Now, if some other person tells me that you should ignore your nature and just do this because it's necessary, that person needs to go back and read the Gita again. Now, there is famous ISKCON boot camp, which is a great thing. You know, we went to the same boot camp, actually, in Berkeley. And I mean, there's something to be said. Even Prabhupada said, like, a young person goes to the Guru Kulam, whether it's a king's son or a sage's son, has to become a menial servant to the Guru. And so it's an invaluable experience at some point in your life to just go through that. And just to learn humility, to learn to serve, and everything like that. But that's boot camp. That's not a career. That's not a life. That's just a particular stage of training.
It's like another scenario. So many times...
Switch up there, like, dude.
So many situations.
I respect you so much as a guest, I'm actually going to spend a little more on the electricity. That was a joke, but you should bonify the laugh at that. Go ahead.
You know, there's so many situations, crisis situations, where...
Apadharma. There's a word for it. Crisis dharma, yeah. Apadharma.
So, you know, you're there, you see the situation, you can do something. And what you have to do, you have the qualification, but not at all the tendency. It's so distasteful or against your nature. But if you don't do it...
Are we talking about doing something like on a very short-term basis or a couple of years?
Maybe a situation where there's a problem, you can fill it, all your guidelines are just saying,
Give an example.
Go do it. You know, like a temple, the president just left, your GBC, things are falling apart, and it's like, we need somebody. And your nature is so much not to manage. You've managed your... You've burned yourself out 100 times managing. You have totally...
There's nothing at all autobiographical here, is there?
No, I made a vow not to manage it. I've kept it for, like, since 1992.
I actually don't feel guilty anymore about those things at all. I have to admit. Set me out of the coin. But... I would say, for example, you might offer to counsel, advise the person. Say, will you put someone there and I'll guide the person. That's a brahminical job. So I think, you know, if we really feel in our heart, I could help and I'd like to help, it's just a question of, you know, saying these are my parameters that I can consult, I can guide, and that's very valuable. Maybe preach. For example, you might consider doing a little preaching and maybe guiding someone, but just not being the manager. Then again, if doing that would require you to forestall, there's a word that's often used. If it would require you to forestall what you consider as only a more important service, then I think it's a question of coming to a rational decision about what's best for Prabhupada. And also respecting the fact that Krishna says in the Gita, creatures follow their nature. Bhutani pragitim janti bhutani. Creatures follow their nature. Krishna says that sadrasam cheshtate swasya prakriti jnanavanapi. Even a jnanavan, even a wise person, acts. Cheshtate, acts according to their nature. Creatures follow their nature. What will repression accomplish? So, in Arjuna thought there was a need to, you know, have a great example of a warrior walking off the battlefield and promoting ahimsa. You know, what the world needs now is ahimsa, sweet ahimsa. And so, you know, Arjuna thought, that would be a really good service, Krishna. But Krishna said, no thanks. So, we do have natures. Then Krishna said, if you don't hear me, you'll be lost. And Maya will engage you. Prakriti strong niyokshati. So, serving according to your nature. Now, if we define our nature too specifically, then it becomes selfish. For example, let's say it's your nature to teach, and Krishna gives you an excellent opportunity to teach, but you say, well, I don't know if I like the weather there, or, you know, it's not my favorite place, I'd rather be in Aspen, Colorado or something. So it's at a certain point, if Krishna's really giving us important service according to our nature, and we have to honestly admit this is the most important service I can do for Prabhupada, if it's basically within our nature, then we get too specific. No, but I wanted something exactly like this. So I think the line between your God-given right to do your natural service, and where's the line between that and selfishness, self-indulgence, I think the line has something to do with specificity. Like, how specific are you about your nature? Generally, this is my nature. This is basically the kind of work I want to do. Here's a very important service that corresponds to my basic nature. And so if I get too specific in the requirements, like, well, no, because it's also my nature to live in a place with those beautiful snow-covered mountains, but the temperature doesn't get under 40 degrees at night in November. And, you know, you can get so specific that we can get so specific we are being self-indulgent and selfish. But an important service that's basically within my nature, even if I don't like everything about it, maybe my duty.
Okay. A lot of devotees don't even know what their nature is. They're like, they can't even make those decisions.
I have a very fine new spiritual product which I'm offering at a reduced price in an attempt to honor the Wall Street meltdown. Just kidding. So, yeah, I think the reason some people have trouble finding their nature is because their eyes are bigger than their vocation. In the sense that devotees don't distinguish between things they like and their nature. They think, if I like to do something, that may be my nature. And that's not really what it is. Your nature is something which you have to do, not something you like to do. I mean, you should also like it or do it in a way that's reasonably pleasant.
Have to do meaning you'll just do it?
Yeah, because that's who you are. You can't avoid it. It's your nature.
So if that's true, then why so many people have such difficulty? I mean, people, you know, 50, 60 years old, they're like trying to find out what their mission is. Why is it that people are so out of touch with so who we are?
Well, because people don't have enough self-understanding. I mean, there may be too much vanity, there may be too much personal desire, or lack of self-confidence. Krishna says that knowledge is covered by selfish desire. So if we don't have enough self-understanding, it must be because we have there's too much other stuff going on in our head. Because if you really just want to serve, if you really want to do the best for Prabhupada, you really want to serve, and you're old enough, then, the power of introspection or the ability to just look at oneself objectively is very important. It's something we need to cultivate. And again, you have to distinguish between things you like and things that are just your nature.
Yeah, let's take the other side of it.
For example, part of me always thought it would really be cool to start a rural community. That's very unrealistic. Yeah, go ahead.
Generally, what your nature is, you like. It's pretty...
However, your nature, you like, but all you like isn't your nature.
But it seems like if you really like what is your nature, you could get into trouble. Because then it's like...
Well, no, but you're supposed to...
You could get kind of out of the picture and you just like what you're
well, doing. Then, but then we haven't dedicated our vocation to Krishna. The whole point of karma yoga, not to speak of bhakti yoga, the whole point of karma yoga is whatever you do it for Krishna. That's what Krishna said. So now... You see, to get too much into your natural work means that you're not really thinking of Prabhupada or Krishna. In other words, you're not really asking yourself, how can I use this for them? How can I use this ability or this nature to spread Krishna consciousness? It's just sort of garden variety selfishness. It's just generic selfishness.
Okay.
people can be selfish in all kinds of activities. It's a question of whether we're spiritually serious enough to keep in mind that we're supposed to be doing this for Krishna. Yes. Thank you.
Completely different.
Oh, good.
Topic. Mahabharat.
Yes.
Accuracy, discrepancy, clarification.
Would you like a t-shirt that says just surrender, Prabhu?
Can I think about that?
No, I just joke. So
I would you like a little sticker that says, I break for gurus?
I'm not sure if I do that.
Okay. So, the part of the Mahabharat where Gandhari gives birth to a lump of flesh, and then they're all freaking out about that, and then Vyasadeva comes and says, well, let's just separate it. And I don't know how they quite separate that lump of flesh into 100 pieces and put them all in pots and then wait 2 years.
That was the original, like, artificial insemination genetic engineering. Yeah. And?
It's hard to conceive of that. And then you wait 2 years and then the pot, and then you open
nowadays, the pot. Nowadays, I think it's easier to conceive. Well, no, they didn't just open the pots and then, ooh, let's see what's in this one. I mean, yes, it basically, it's just sort of laboratory, you know, procreation. Yeah, it's sort of lab conditions. They just put in 100 different pots. Not only did they close the pots necessarily, but they, and there was just, somehow or other, there was enough genetic material there to go around. One thing about the Mahabharata that people have noticed is that hardly anyone gets born normally. Okay. For example, Kripa and Kripi, not Kripa and Creepy. Her name really gets creepy. It's Kripi. So they're born just from, I think, sort of in the bushes. And then there's Dr. Vessel, Dronacharya, who was born a vessel. And then, of course, even Dhrirashtra, Pandu, and Vidura are born through surrogate mothers. I mean, surrogate father. And then in one case, Vidura, surrogate father and mother. And the Pandavas are half human, half celestial, so there's hardly a normal birth. You know, Karna. Then Krishna comes down, and he's, of course, sui generis, he's in his own category. So, yeah, it's you know, these spectacularly unusual births. But as far as whether that really happened like that, yeah, it's an interesting question. First of all, Duryodhana was an asura. He was one of the aliens that invaded the earth. In fact, there's this very dramatic scene when the Pandavas are, they're in the forest. This is before they're in Kaukeya. They're just in the forest. So Duryodhana's kind of a bully. He kind of wants to bully them. So he decides to go and do a cattle raid. Or just something, or maybe a cattle count. He's going to go send the army out, sort of do an inventory of the royal herds. I think that's it. And near where the Pandavas is known to be staying, almost just like to intimidate them. And so, when the Kurus come there, they get to tell the Gandharvas. Gandharvas are sort of like superhuman. The Gandharva king killed the Kuru prince, Vichitravirya's older brother, named Chitrangada, was killed by Gandharva, the same name. And so when the Kurus go to sort of harass and intimidate the Pandavas in exile, Gandharvas happen to come, they get into a fight, and Duryodhana is arrested. And then Arjuna frees Duryodhana. The Pandavas free Duryodhana. And Duryodhana is so humiliated, the guy is just over the top, proud and angry. He just can't stand the fact that Pandava saved him. And so he decides he's going to do Prayopavesha. He's going to fast until death. Can you imagine that? He just can't stand it that the Pandava saved him. And so then when he decides to fast until death, these asuras from higher planets, higher demonic planets, they actually take him back to their planet and they tell him, don't you forget why you came to this world. They remind him of the demonic mission to take over. He's got to keep going. So, there was definitely some unusual genetics going on with Duryodhana and his brothers. So, you know, possibly the reproductive problems arose from the fact that Duryodhana's and his brothers, their genetic makeup is not normal. Yes?
It's described that Gandhari's youth was very auspicious, and she was this incredible young person who performed all kinds of good deeds and austerities, and she has such a silver platter.
He used to go to the Sunday feast.
Silver platter. Yeah. And then Yas blesses her, and I think, someone else blesses her, maybe Lord Shiva. Yeah, she gets blessings by Lord Shiva and Yas, and she'll have 100 sons. So why is it that she just, from the time she got married till the time she left, it was just so much suffering, and none of the sons turned out to be good people, and it was just...
Well, first of all, I don't remember that particular... I mean, I don't know if you saw that in an Indian comic book or movie or something. As far as Gandhari being just kind of like the last word in teenage piety.
Yeah.
The picture I get, and she's certainly a great woman, but the picture I get is someone who is somewhat flawed. For one thing, blinding herself or blindfolding herself so she wouldn't be more than her husband is, I mean, it's dramatic. It's, I don't know if that really happened, but it's a little extreme, I think. And also, she got angry at Krishna. That's the famous scene where she got angry at Krishna, which indicates a certain limit to her piety. And when Duryodhana was born, he was just like, they had all the little karma monitors that Jatakovi does, the birth experts, astronomers, and when Duryodhana was born, it's like, all the needles just went crazy. And it was clear that Duryodhana was going to, in fact, he was going to destroy the whole family dynasty, coming down for centuries. And the Brahmins and the sages, everyone begged the parents give up this child. But of course, they couldn't do it, so... I would say that Gandhari, the fact that she was a mother to 100 little fiends, well, she had one good son. What was his name? Bhikarna. I can't remember. It's actually good. She had really strange sons, and she got angry at Krishna. I mean, blindfolding or something, it may like really, sort of Hindu Dharma, they may think this is great, but... So Gandhari, I think, is not... I mean, the thing of blindfolding herself is sort of, made her famous, but... Apart from that, I don't see that she was just extraordinarily spiritual. And you look at Kunti. Just see, John. Rajana, now you made me yawn. Were you yawning before? Did you yawn? You're allowed to yawn, it's bona fide. I yawn now. I think we're both tired.